Now our weekly rendezvous with Jill Bevilacqua as she presents episode 42 of The Vatican Centuries, a programme produced by Sean Patrick Lovett in which Jill takes us back in time to rediscover some of the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican down the centuries. While last week we heard how the temporal power of the papacy ends, how Pius IX proclaims the dogma of the Immaculate Conception and calls the First Vatican Council, in this week's episode, by the title of Cataclysm, we hear how the papal chamberlain becomes Pope Leo XIII, how he issues the encyclical Rerum Novarum, and how this Roman pontiff offers the cardinal's hat to John Henry Newman.
Our own times are almost at hand. There are those still living among us who remember the latter events which follow, for they lived through them, while the personalities are familiar childhood figures.
In the last decades of the 19th century, the pace of life was still gentle, but already industry and technology were making themselves felt. The European continent was still their centre, and the old world continued to grow rich and to expand.
Rivalry was developing between the groups of European powers over trade, colonialization, and naval and military supremacy. Two alliances were formed, the Triple Entente between Britain, France, and Russia, and the Triple Alliance between Germany, Austria, and Hungary. The stage was set for conflict.
But men still sought to conquer nature. This was the era of polar exploration, of Peary, Amundsen, and the gallant band of Robert Falcon Scott.
In 1912, the great ocean liner Titanic struck an iceberg on her maiden voyage to New York and sank with over 1,500 passengers.
Only a few years previously, the city of San Francisco had been destroyed by earthquake and fire. Acts of God abound in every age.
Medicine was going ahead in leaps and bounds. X-rays, adrenaline, vitamins and blood groups. Pierre and Marie Curie discovered radium, while a man named Sigmund Freud published a disturbing book. Psychoanalysis had arrived.
Inventions proliferated. After the phonograph came the gramophone, the fountain pen, the safety razor, zip fasteners, tape recorders, vacuum cleaners.
But some of man's new toys soared above all the others. And when, in 1903, Wilbur and Orville Wright made the first controlled flight in a heavier-than-air machine, it seemed that nothing was impossible to the mighty human intellect.
More homely, but likewise a sign of the future, was the appearance of the first motor car, built by Benz and Daimler, and later popularized by Henry Ford, who put the cheap motor car on the general market.
It was a time that saw the beginnings of nuclear physics, of experiments in cinematography, and, nearer home, radio telegraphy. An Italian named Guglielmo Marconi was sending wireless messages.
People were dancing to the music of Johann Strauss, enjoying opera after opera of Verdi. Serious folk were listening to Tchaikovsky and Brahms. Delighted English audiences laughed at the operettas of Gilbert and Sullivan, which poked fun at pomposity.
The paintings of Gauguin, Renoir, Van Gogh and Toulouse-Lautrec kept the Impressionists in the forefront, while the plays of Anton Chekhov and the novels of Henry James gave the intelligentsia food for thought.
Agitation was the order of the day. The Great London Dock Strike in 1889 was supported by Cardinal Manning of Westminster. The suffragette movement was in full activity. The granting of old-age pensions gave recognition to senior citizens. The 20th century lifestyle was on the way in. And in Rome, its effects were already beginning to show.
One of the essential acts a pope must perform before he dies is to appoint a chamberlain or camerlengo of the Holy Roman Church. Always a cardinal, the chamberlain is responsible for administration of church property and revenues while the papal throne is vacant. On the pope's death, he automatically becomes head of the sacred college, assembles the conclave, and remains in charge until a new pope is elected.
Traditionally, the cardinal chamberlain had little chance of being elected pope. But on February the 20th, 1878, after the speediest election in history, only three ballots were taken, the man who had guided the church through the difficult period of the interregnum was chosen to succeed Pio IX. He took the name of Leo XIII.
the coronation of the first pope without temporal power took place in the Sistine Chapel instead of in St. Peter's, because the Italian authorities refused to guarantee law and order. Leo XIII infuriated the Italian liberals and displeased the Romans by giving the customary blessing to the city and world not from the central balcony of St. Peter's, but instead from inside the basilica. Coexistence between church and state was not going to be easy.
'68-year-old Gioacchino Pecci was no haphazard choice for the chair of Peter. He had wide pastoral experience. He was a born diplomat and an able administrator.
But what the new pope represented more than anything else was a more open, conciliatory attitude to the secular world. Pius IX had made the church a close corporation, isolating the papacy and turning his back on the modern world. Leo XIII realized that the church could and should live in harmony with it. Only then would she recover her loss of influence, and the papacy its prestige.
Pope Leo XIII is probably remembered today chiefly for his encyclical Rerum Novarum, published on the 15th of May, 1891. The pope saw that the church would have to appeal directly to the workers if they were not to be lost to socialism.
Leo XIII was 68 when he became pope, and he lived to be over 90. The aim of his pontificate was to Christianize modern life and to modernize Christian life. He believed he could present the church and the papacy as a world power with a spiritual mission.
But by the turn of the century, Leo's optimism had faded. The fanatical hate of the Freemasons and the general aversion for the organization of the Catholic Church was closing in on him. The Roman question, too, was a constant drawback to real dialogue. An article in the Daily Telegraph of the year 1899 described the Pope's position.
The Pope is alone in the Vatican, without a friend among the governments of the world, without territory, without treasure, without an army, without power, without a voice in the Senate of Nations, a prisoner in his own palace, begirt by the troops of a hostile king. His visible sovereignty is indeed gone. Nevertheless, his invisible sovereignty was perhaps never stronger than today. With all the forces of the world against him, he has fought the fight well and drawn tighter the bonds of respect and love and obedience which knit the Roman Church into one harmonious whole. Its unity never more absolute, its purity never more apparent, its authority never more loyally recognized.
In 1903, Giuseppe Sarto, Cardinal Patriarch of Venice, ascended the papal throne. Known above all as the Pope of Frequent Communion, Pius X lowered the age for reception of the Eucharist to 7 years and encouraged devotion to the sacrament. He also promulgated a new version of the Catechism and himself gave Sunday school sessions to the children of Rome. Two of those children were Carola and Francesca McMurrah.
We saw him every time we could, we'd go to see him. We just loved Pius X. We loved those beautiful blue eyes, you know. I remember saying to Mother, Mother, the Holy Father has blue eyes. And they were full of light. And they looked down on you, I don't know, with such light and a twinkle in them too, you know. But such sweetness, you know. Everybody loved those eyes, you know. They were the eyes of a saint.
It fell to the gentle Pius X to be the helpless witness of a cataclysm which no other pope before him could have imagined.
On June the 28th, 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria was assassinated by a Bosnian student.
Instantly, the dogs of war were unleashed. The First World War, a war which was to claim 40 million human lives.
When Pius X was asked to bless the Austro-Hungarian troops, he exclaimed, "I bless peace," but he did not live to see it. On the 20th of August that same year, he died, so people said, of a broken heart, while all around him the lamps of Europe went out.
And special thanks there once again to Jill Bevilacqua for part 42 of The Vatican Centuries, and of course to Sean Patrick Lovett, who produced this series. They'll be back again at the same time next week, so be sure to join them then.